Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that. And find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps, because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Greetings, humans. You have entered the Command Zone, your destination for all aspects of Elder Dragon Highlander. Enjoy your stay.
It was close. You get the idea.
How's it going, everybody? You're listening to the Command Zone Podcast. My name is Jimmy Wong.
How's it? It's Josh Lee Kwai.
And we have a special episode for you guys today because we are sitting in the hotel room at PAX, which is the Penny Arcade Expo here in Seattle, Washington, with special guest, Glenn Jones.
Also special Glenn, yeah.
Special Glenn Jones, everybody. Glenn, yay! We know from the Masters of Modern, you were the original co-host with Alex Kessler, which is our sister podcast. And then you got hired by Wizards of the Coast.
Very, very shortly after we started that, yeah.
Almost because of it. I mean, let's not lie.
Everyone was at like, have you guys heard this podcast?
This guy is awesome.
We should hire him on. So Glenn is no longer with that podcast, but you're at Wizards now. And today we're going to talk about Conspiracy 2, which is...
awesome.
Yeah.
I played four turns of it.
I bet it was really good.
And I can already tell it was awesome. It's no surprise to our listeners because I love Conspiracy in general.
Yeah. So Conspiracy 2 came out. Conspiracy 1 was 2 years ago. That was one of the first episodes we recorded, was a full set review of Conspiracy for God knows why. It was 2 hours.
We were excited.
Yeah. I mean, we're equally excited about Conspiracy 2, but we won't do a set review. We might talk about the
cards. We might do like a breakdown, one of our side board episodes about it, but probably not a card by card, limited resources style.
Yeah, certainly.
We're probably not doing that.
No. But before we start,
yeah.
We should talk very quickly because we have a sponsor for the show, and that sponsor is Card Kingdom. Very excitedly, we're actually going to go to Card Kingdom tomorrow. Glenn, you're invited.
I will be there. I love Card Kingdom.
Sweet. So we'll be there Friday Night Magic. We're going to hang out and play with whoever wants to show up from PAX that doesn't have a badge and play some EDH, maybe draft some Conspiracy. CardKingdom.com/CommandZone is where you guys can go if you want to purchase any cards from the website and support the show. I'm excited for you to experience the card chat for the first time.
Yeah, I'm stoked to check it out. I've seen pictures. I hear everybody talk about it. It's kind of the gold standard for card shops. So
it definitely is.
I'm pretty stoked. Use the affiliate link. Support the show. We do appreciate it.
Yeah.
All right. Glenn, do you want to tell us what your title was on Conspiracy 2?
Sure. My title for Conspiracy 2 is... it's a little convoluted. It was actually the first set I started working on, really, when I joined Wizards, which was January 1st, 2015.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I got there, and Conspiracy 2 had basically wrapped design. It was starting up development. And I'm an editor in Magic R&D, a card set editor. So a lot of my work is on, like, tinkering with actual wordings on cards, making sure that they're intelligible, that the rules work, that there aren't bizarro loopholes that we don't expect. That kind of thing. So I worked closely with the rules manager and the lead developer of the set to do all of that. So the set was in development. One of the perks of a wizard's job is that when you first get a job in R&D, you probably don't really know how to do your job yet. Mm-hmm. So while they spend time teaching you, you're kind of useless for a lot of what will become your regular duties, but you're excellent for playtesting because everyone does know how to play Magic. So
that sounds like a dream come true.
Everyone who joins R&D winds up doing a lot of playtesting in their first month or two that they're there. And so I had just joined R&D. Conspiracy 2 was doing development playtesting. that meant I did a lot of Conspiracy 2 playtesting.
That's awesome. And when you say it's out of design, that specifically means that the world and sort of like what they're planning for the set is done, and now they're into developing the actual cards, or?
No, that's so there's definitely a phase where they explore the world and talk about what it means to return to a world or mm-hmm. to come to a world for the first time. But the actual design phase does have a card file that they hand off, and its purpose is really to manifest those original ideas. You know, mm-hmm. if someone's like, we want a mechanic that creates, like a lot of attacking or things like that, that would be kind of like exploratory or vision work, and then design is going to come up with cards that manifest what, we now know as goad, a mechanic that really incentivizes that kind of thing. So
your first few months maybe or a few weeks there, you play tested a lot, and then you said it was convoluted. So what did that what's the convolution like? What did that evolve into as far as working on the set?
I initially was not really working on the set proper. I was just play testing it, but I am a card set editor, and that means I need card sets to edit, and I sort of have specialized in ancillary products since I got to Wizards.
Our favorite products, by the way.
I also like them a lot, so I was super excited to be able to do that. And Conspiracy 2 didn't really have an editor when I showed up, and rather than give it to have one of the more experienced people have to make time for that set, they decided to let me try it for a little while and see how it goes.
Uh-huh.
And it wound up going well enough that I was just made the lead editor of the set. I still had a lot of help from the senior editors around, Tim Aiton and Del Ogle.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And Matt Tabak was still on our team at that point, as well as being rules manager. So all of those guys were super helpful at making sure that I didn't screw up too badly. And it was an interesting experience. I learned a ton doing Conspiracy 2, and I'm still learning more every day. So.
I'm presuming that R&D specifically focuses on standard as sort of like the top priority, right? Sort of the standard sets that are coming out year by year, and the ancillary sets have separate teams for them, it seems like, or at least are, because you were saying the editor mm-hmm. would have to sort of make time for a set like this.
It was more just, we produce a lot of products, and one of the reasons I was hired in the first place was that the editing team was overworked with the sheer number of
them.
So it was that's just how it's been. You always got to make time. I wouldn't say that we do less attention necessarily. Like, for example, Take the Crown got a full design team, full development cycle, full editing cycle. Like, those are all the same things standard gets.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't have an FFL, testing standard decks.
Which is the Future League,
mm-hmm.
For the listeners that don't know, which is a league within Wizards that is testing stuff really far ahead of time, correct?
Pretty far ahead, and it's like a team, really.
Right.
And it changes. People in R&D rotate in and out, but there's usually, a couple of core developers who mm-hmm. really keep things solid and
but you don't need that for something like Conspiracy, because it's not going to interact with the other sets in the same way. So I would think that's like more of a thing where, like, when Kaladesh comes out, you have to worry about how that's going to interact with the sets that are going to be in the block both before and after. But Conspiracy, right? It's just it's going to be standalone. So you don't need a Future League. It's going to work within itself anyway.
Yeah. You don't need a Future League, but there are that we did consult with the developers who do make up the FFL team, to see, hey, like, do you think this card is too strong in Legacy?
Right, right.
Do you think this card might be unfun in Cubes or in Commander? Because we want to make sure that the formats that Conspiracy 2 is legal in is bringing fun cards.
You guys say, is this card too powerful for Commander?
Yes. We definitely ask. We're more interested in whether it's fun.
Right.
We don't mm-hmm. mind if it's powerful as long as it is also
like
enjoyable.
Right,
because, if a card is unfun and also, obnoxiously powerful, then there's not a lot of reason to give it to the Commander audience
right.
because they're going to naturally skew away from it themselves. When you start losing friends for your cards, it's, not great.
Well, that's great to hear. I'm glad I was wrong. I'm glad that there is, sort of equal attention paid across all these sets, because Conspiracy, again, like we said, is one of our favorite sets of all time. Now, what was your experience with the original set? I remember you saying earlier that you hadn't played it as much.
Yeah, I was working in L.A., when the original set came out. So I was quite busy. I wasn't playing quite as much Magic, although I did start playing a little bit more towards the end before I got hired, ironically enough. I did a couple of drafts, and I enjoyed it, generally. I knew that there was something there. Mm-hmm. I really liked the idea of Conspiracies. I really liked the idea of how they could interact with things like Cube and Commander and offer
certainly.
This space to explore cards that, we don't get a lot of in Standard, because you just can't print that many cards cater to this audience in a standard format But when you can have like a whole set dedicated to that audience, that's great, you know, really fun. So it was sort of doing a lot of the same work that the annualized Commander product does, but in a totally new experience, which is very impressive. That was the thing that struck me the most about it, is it was just another way to play Magic.
And clearly it did well enough for a second set, so.
It did at least that well, yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Josh, you contributed to approximately 5% of that.
Our playgroup had to be a big chunk of the percentage of, we played the crap out of it, but it's perfect for Commander players, and we always encourage people to try Conspiracy and now Conspiracy 2, because it really is just a draft format of Commander. It's really made for, and Jimmy and I have said this many times too, which is that our two favorite formats are Commander and Draft.
Mm-hmm.
And so Conspiracy is like made for us, because that's what the set is.
It's a nice wedding of the two, I'd say.
Yeah, there's a huge overlap, I think, in what those audiences enjoy.
Yes.
As far as those Venn diagram circles go. Mm-hmm. But I do also like that there are slices on the outside where you can find something different in each one.
Right.
Yeah, certainly. Now, you said to us before we started the podcast, you were on the design mini team. What is that?
Yeah, it was actually during the development cycle. But mini teams are pretty typical in R&D. They happen with every set. They're usually centered around very specific needs of the set, and it's sort of a way for the lead developer wants some additional insights or ideas. You know, there is a core team of usually 5 to 6 people who are generating a lot of example cards and mechanic ideas and things like that in both standard and ancillary products. Like, that's going to happen. But if you just want to generate more or get some outside input, a lot of the time we'll do mini teams where, you know, they'll be like, here's a mechanic, like build cards with this or come up with a new mechanic.
Cool.
Or story characters like planeswalkers and moments that we manifest on cards like Imprisoned in the Moon, which is a card I built in a mini team.
That card, by the way, was my standout card for like, this is a Commander card through and through. For everyone that's looking at this set, like, you want this.
Yeah, I really like, personally, story. Like, my background in Magic is actually very competitive. I've played on the Pro Tour, and I used to play PTQs really regularly, and that was just all I did all the time. But so I know I can do work on these teams that are building cards that, you know, might be targeted at constructed formats or things like that. But I really think that as far as designing cards go, I'm actually better at top-down designs, where it's like, I need a card that, you know, manifests or evokes this particular event or sensation. Like, what does that card look like? And those are the cards I really like to work on.
Right.
So for Conspiracy 2, the mini team I went on, we looked at cards that might wind up being Legacy playable. That was one of the things that we talked about doing. So like Sanctum Prelate and I think Recruiter of the Guard. I know Sanctum Prelate did come out of that mini team. I'm not sure if Recruiter of the Guard was already in the file or not at that point.
Right.
And I was on a mini team for the sets Planeswalkers as well.
Right.
We talked about Duretti and Kaya, Ghost Assassin.
And Kaya is your design, right?
It is really, really close to like what I submitted to the mini team. Basically, I think the numbers were very close, if not the same. And then we added a little bit to the first ability, but the other two abilities are just exactly what I submitted, which was submitted based on work done by Kelly Diggs, who, you know, he was like, we have this character, gave a little bit about her background and her power set, and you know, that, and he was like, you know, we need to build this Planeswalker character, like, you know, make her cool. And I was like, okay. And so I knew Conspiracy 2 wasn't a standard set, so Planeswalkers don't have the same kind of burden that they have in standard, where, you know, they have to appeal to a lot of audiences, and you have to also make sure that
they,
you're not accidentally doing something really crazy. Yeah.
Jace, Mind Sculptor? We actually haven't talked about Kaya Ghost Assassin on the channel yet, so let's just briefly read the card.
Sure.
It's a brand new Planeswalker, 2, a white and a black. Comes out with 5 loyalty. She's Planeswalker Kaya, the Ghost Assassin.
Yeah, we did talk about her one episode, but just still read it. Yeah.
0. Not very many Planeswalkers with 0 abilities, by the way. I really like this. Exile Kaya, Ghost Assassin, or up to 1 target creature. Return that card to the battlefield under its owner's control at the beginning of your next upkeep. You lose 2 life. -1. Each opponent loses 2 life and you gain 2 life. And -2. Each opponent discards a card and you draw a card. So there's no ultimate ability here. She starts with 5, which is really impressive. But I really love her 0 the most. What Was that a part of your original design to sort of like flicker her out for a
Yeah, that
cycle?
Was the flicker was actually the first thing I had for the Planeswalker, because as soon as Kelly was like, hey, I have this Planeswalker and she's got ghost powers basically and like affects ghosts, I was like, okay, like
that seems like flickering.
Immediately, like flickering certainly comes to mind, but also I'm personally very enamored with Planeswalkers that function in unique ways.
Uh-huh.
Like Sark and the Mad is one of my favorite Planeswalkers. Tybalt is actually a Planeswalker I like, even though he's bad because...
You don't hear that very often.
Yeah, I just like the boldness of the design. You know, like, I like Planeswalkers that push the boundary of what you expect.
Right.
A Planeswalker like Obnixilus Reignited, for example, is certainly strong, like sees constructed play, but he's sort of what you come to expect
from
a
Planeswalker. All those abilities are like, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, okay, yeah, like that lines up with sort of what I imagine it would be.
Mm-hmm.
So seeing a Planeswalker that didn't have an ultimate to build to was interesting to me, and also a Planeswalker that didn't have a plus.
Right.
Because in that way, she's kind of the opposite of Elspeth, who was all pluses in her first incarnation. And so I really like wanted to play around with that idea, and the flicker just played supernaturally with that. My first version of Kaya actually didn't have the ability to exile a creature.
Mm-hmm.
That was suggested by another member of the mini-team. I think it was Ken Nagel, actually. The mini-team was being led by Yanni Skolnick, and Brian Hawley, who are both developers, and Ken Nagel, who is a designer, and they were all the experienced members of the team.
I played Conspiracy 1 with Ken Nagel,
mm-hmm.
and I killed him with a Trastodon. He was not happy about it.
I don't know why he wouldn't be happy. Ken loves big green creatures.
I know, he signed the Trastodon later, actually.
Yeah,
so
he just doesn't love being killed.
Maybe he did like it, who knows?
So... Yeah. In your original incarnation, could Kaya only flicker herself? And
yeah, she only flickered herself, and I, also being not smart, didn't tag the two life onto it. So you could just cast Kaya and then just flicker her until you were ready to take control of the game.
Which
right.
you can do
in
Commander because the two life don't matter.
Don't matter.
We'll see about that.
Yeah.
But yeah.
No, not Conspiracy. Commander. The two life don't matter. In Conspiracy, the two life matters.
Yeah, it was either Yanni or Brian who suggested the two life, and Ken who suggested we make it a creature just because people would find that more appealing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, yeah, that obviously sounded pretty good. But the Siphon Soul and Siphon Mind were exactly my pitches, and those just stuck because those also felt very ghostly to me.
Right.
The idea that she drains, that's especially like, you know, she has these cool daggers that do this work on ghosts,
mm-hmm.
and those call to mind a number of, you know, various enchanted weapons throughout the history of fantasy storytelling, and all of those kinds of weapons are very draining, so I was like, well, you know, let's play into that trope that we have.
Right.
Well, it's interesting because the Siphon Soul, which is the, you drain your opponents for two each, and then you gain two life, they've changed the wording recently, and I'm assuming you're part of this. I'm assuming because of Commander, it used to be you would gain the amount of life lost.
Yeah, that's a knob. It's been certainly turned. I think that generally speaking, cards have just gone in that direction.
Yeah.
It's not a decision I've been particularly a part of, but just in general, we tend to do the drain and not have it scale super aggressively.
Which I think is good because some of the most powerful, some of the most powerful cards in Commander are the ones that feel like they're broken because multiplayer exists and they weren't designed for it. So it's nice to know that you guys are actually thinking of, like, okay, well, how does this work in multiplayer also?
Yeah.
Because it'd be so easy to build this card and not, oh, goodness, in Conspiracy, so maybe it's not the best example. But I have noticed that as a thing over just the last few sets.
Certainly. I mean, I don't think the people who put a nerve in Urza Saga for the first time, you know, expected to see Conspiracy coming along down the road. And, like, it's great that a nerve is doing that.
Yeah.
It caters for this audience. But, yeah, like, the things that scale with the number of players are actually just a lot harder to balance, I imagine, is one of the concerns. And without an FFL to make sure that things are balanced, it's very safe
Safer.
And easy.
Yeah.
Yeah,
And it doesn't necessarily underpower the card either. Like, the ability to drain everyone of two and you're only gaining two is still pretty good. Now, a side note, there are 221 cards in the set, but there is a 222nd card, which is Kaya Ghost Assassin, but with an alternate art. Did you have any idea that this was going to be a part of the set?
I did. It was sort of pitched to me. I think it was actually Jeremy Jarvis, who is one of the leads on our Worlds team, and he was like, hey, you know, do you think this would be cool? We're thinking about doing it as, you know, an additional way to make Kaya more awesome.
Everybody's supposed to say, no, that's not cool at all.
Yeah,
who's going to say that?
My card, too, are there.
And the funniest thing is, like, I was just like, you know, oh, like we did in Plane Shift with Tangarth and Ertai. Sweet. And it's like, that's just, so, it's so long ago. But like, I remember when I was like this tiny child, those cards were awesome to me. Like I saw that that had happened. And I was like, oh, I got to get that Ertai. That card's so cool. And
that was your card.
I mean, I never did get the Ertai, but I did get the card.
You know, I'm sure someone could help you out.
So yeah, I was really thrilled that we were going to do that. And I think both arts are great. And it's just really cool. I was happy that we sort of kept it under wraps long enough for someone to discover it.
Yeah, that was
which
great.
Was really fun too. Yeah,
that's my favorite, is when something that is purposefully a secret takes the appropriate amount of time to be revealed. Actually, it's very supernatural, kind of like Kaya. It was great. the art flickered in at the right time.
Glenn, what to you is the most important thing that makes like conspiracy as a thing what it is?
Well, I mean, I think multiplayer obviously is the biggest thing people think about. But especially in today's world, you know, we have a ton of awesome story going on, and I really like the world of Fiora. So I was glad that Conspiracy 2 returns there and that it's sort of become its home. So this idea of this multiplayer attached kind of plane, and this, so it's got a story and gameplay experience that are actually woven together.
Yeah.
That is, I think, my actual favorite part about it. And we get to show these characters, some new, some old, you know, like Doretti returning is awesome. And you see Doretti's black now. It's like, oh, what does that mean? And we got to just do a ton of cool things narratively that, you know, it's not the main focus of our story. Like Fiora is this like kind of side plane. There isn't a lot going on over there, but that's related to our main story, I should say. You know, there's tons of people getting murdered left and right. That's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, Brago gone down. I love the original sort of the teasing of the set when it came out, sort of like the, like, what's happening here? Like, how is Marchesa, like, sort of coming? And being my personal favorite commander, too, it was great to see a character that otherwise doesn't get much love in the Magic story, just because it doesn't tie into, like, the Gatewatch or sort of our main characters currently.
An aspect of that that I also was associated with was the letters or proclamations that we did on the ad cards for Eternal Masters. Yeah, I edited and put together those along with our excellent typesetting team, which you deserve a ton of credit for lining all of those up on the edges of cards.
Yeah, if you didn't
know. That was crazy,
yeah.
In Eternal Masters, on the back of the tokens cards, you would see like half of a line of text that was cut in half, and you had to line up every token to make a proclamation from Marchesa and Brago, right?
Adriana. Yeah, right? it was Marchesa's proclamation that she was now queen and Brago had died and she was the rightful heir because of reasons. And also, you know, the note that there was a little bit of rebellion going on and you guys should ignore that. And then Adriana, who is in open revolt, like, this is, no, like, this is wrong. Like, Brago forever, Marchesa's an assassin, says so right on her type line.
Was there anything that from the design team's perspective had to return from the original set that they were like, this is such a hit, this has to be back in the new set?
Again, like, I wasn't on the design team proper, but certainly there are tenets of conspiracy, right? You know, there's conspiracies themselves. Obviously, those are certainly the biggest things that definitely have to come back.
Right.
Outside of that, I know that they wanted to touch back on returning characters because that's the cachet of Fiora. And the draft action cards, which, you know, they're very different this time around. Last time, everything was manifested through artifacts and cogwork. And now we have this narrative where the Academy of Fiora has been dismantled. Muzio's gone, and there aren't any artifacts really around. You'll notice the set is really artifact light compared to its predecessor. And instead, now there's like a lot of color, and the draft action is really pulling you into directions as opposed to being these knobs that everyone has access to during the draft. Which I do think makes things a lot different.
You guys do, obviously, when you came in, you did a lot of playtesting in the in sort of the office. And I'm guessing multiplayer playtesting doesn't happen as much because sets like Conspiracy come around, you know, once every 2 years at this current rate. Do you guys mostly do testing in office to figure out how multiplayer works? Or is there a lot of sort of like anecdotal evidence of like, oh, we play Commander every Monday, so we also have stories from this that we can take into our testing here?
It's funny, actually, because we do a lot of playtesting. Like I mentioned, it was just the primary thing I was really doing when I first joined up was actually playtesting Conspiracy 2. I think I playtested it probably like myself 4 or 5 times, maybe more, and I certainly wasn't on every playtest. But another thing that we do is make playtesting available to departments outside of R&D. We bring in people from all over the company. If they're interested in Magic and mm-hmm. want to see what we're doing and want to offer their feedback and opinions, because R&D, they're super experienced and diverse group of people, but at the same time, you know, they all tend to come from similar backgrounds where they're very enfranchised with Magic. Right. A lot of them have been playing Magic for a really long time. So they have a certain perspective or knowledge, and they might miss things that we would learn from less experienced or differently experienced players.
That's
which,
great.
Fortunately, the company is full of people. A lot of people come to Wizards to work just because it's a great company, not necessarily because they know we're particularly in love with Magic. So mm-hmm. we actually get a number of first-time players in on playtests sometimes. And those players are really useful for making sure that a set is accessible,
right?
Which is nice. And Conspiracy 2 benefited from that. As far as specifically multiplayer playtesting, in addition to the playtesting we did for Conspiracy 2, we do have in constant rotation the Commander annualized release, and that is playtested pretty extensively. So mm-hmm. multiplayer dynamics are really actually pretty well known among the members of teams that actually work on the ancillary products that involve them. So there's a lot of talk about that. Like, we have a pretty good grasp on it, mm-hmm. and I don't think we have to rely on that much theory crafting for multiplayer, which is nice
because
it would be difficult and a little daunting.
Yeah, and if you're playtesting also 99 card decks, you'd obviously need to get in more and more tested because you're trying to figure out what stays consistent, mm-hmm. what works, what mm-hmm. doesn't. So that's
I think
really
it can
out.
Look from the outside because guys like you, Glenn, Gavin, we know, Melissa DeTora, these are all like really high level spiky one-on-one players, and so I think there's maybe a view from the outside of like, well, those people developing the Commander product doesn't seem right. But you play Commander. We play Commander mm-hmm. with Gavin many times. We even play Commander with Melissa.
Yeah.
I think people don't understand that because it looks from the outside again mm-hmm. like these people are going to care about winning when we care about something else maybe as in general.
I care about winning.
but, you know, and I think that's not true at all from the interactions we've had with the Wizards people when we've played a good amount. So
specifically worth calling out for this product is actually Ben Hayes was the lead developer. Sean Main was the lead designer, mm-hmm. picking back up where he left off. But Ben Hayes, his other lead development credit before Conspiracy 2 was Commander 2015.
Oh, okay.
So he went Commander 2015, Conspiracy 2. He's also the lead developer for Commander 2016. Mm-hmm. So, and Ben is this player, very, very experienced, comes from a very competitive background. He's played in plenty of Pro Tours, more than I have for sure. And he's still bringing a lot of talent and a lot of great just design and development work. And I've worked with Ben a lot now. So I just continue to gain a lot of respect for him. And he's also a great developer to edit, I guess, even with all the weirdness that goes on in those sets.
And I feel like, you know, because when you work for Wizards, you're no longer allowed to compete in those level of competitive events. And you're joining the team to make cards for the love of the game. I feel like that really also contributes to, like, hey, we're here to, like, if we're making a multiplayer set, like, we're trying to make the best set as possible. Like, our personal interests almost take a small sidestep because we're trying to build something that's sort of bigger than the sum of our parts. But that's just my theory. I'm just theorizing.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. There might be some of that going on. I don't know. Ben takes pretty seriously all of his work, and he's really easy to work with, and he is consistently just churning out some of my personal favorite sets, both before and after I started working here. So,
let's talk favorites. We'll go through all of these. Josh, you may not be able to answer these as much because you haven't played as much. But let's start off with, what is everyone's favorite mechanic from the set? And it can be a new one, it can be a returning one. I'm currently a big fan of Monarch. Mm. I think it's interesting to see how it's played out so far because, again, in Conspiracy, I found that people like to deck themselves over a course of a game, and some people are now playing 45, 50-card decks. And there's been a lot of times where someone's the Monarch and everyone goes, we don't care, draw your extra card, we watch you get precariously loaded decking yourself, and we know that whatever you draw, as the rest of the table deciding to just sort of bunker up, we can sort of defeat you with it. And that was something I did not expect, because I expected Monarch to be passed left and right just from the appeal of drawing a card your instead would be too great for someone not to be like, I'll swing at you for one in the air or whatever.
What's your favorite?
Josh, deep in thought over here.
I am a big fan of Goad. It's just really fun. I like being able to manipulate people. It comes up in a lot of my favorite games. Mm-hmm. So being able to determine and predict player behavior and especially pit people against one another. I just love all of the things that Goad lets you do. And it's got a little... It's interesting because Goad is also operating in this really temporal space, right? Like, as you get closer to winning the game, Goad gets worse. Because once you're in a two-player game, Goad is mostly just that creature has to attack me, and odds are good that it was probably going to do that anyway if it's a real creature.
Right.
But in the sweet spot, like in the mid-game where you guys are all jockeying for position, just sending a creature the wrong way, really, really strong.
It makes you prioritize, like, it's like, great, I can block your 2-2 with my 1-3, like... Mm-hmm. And the person goes like, well, I guess I'll swing at you. So you really want to find the sweet spot for that.
Having not played it a lot, you know, the conspiracies to me are still, like, sort of the thing. I just love having cards that aren't in my deck but are doing, like, making my deck better.
Commanders and conspiracies, you really like that. Those extra cards and you're starting
it's just like, sweet, I get stuff before I've even done anything.
Yeah, untouchable enchantments.
I find it very, very hard to pass any conspiracy for any reason. Like, it's just like, I don't know, because especially, like, pass pick six or something, it's just like, this card will do something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't even have to put it in my deck, whereas I don't, you know, there are a lot of times like I don't even know what color I am yet. So this, I think there was a good job done where the conspiracies do, a lot of them do have colors tied to them, so you might pass them for that reason. But even today when I was drafting, I was like, I'm not in blue, but this blue conspiracy seems really good. I'm just going to take it, because if I do end up being able to play any blue cards, it'll be great.
Mm-hmm.
So I just love the conspiracy mechanic.
You drafted this one today, right?
Yes, Emissary's Ploy.
This has to be one of my favorites.
Yeah, the story was, I'm drafting Gavin standing behind me. It's like pick 7 or 8, and it comes around, and I look at it, and I turn to Gavin, and I go, this card seems really good, you know, but I haven't drafted the set, and it came around late, so what do I know? And he goes, oh, I designed that card. It is really good. You should take it. So I did. So it's a conspiracy to start, which... So it starts in your command zone, face up, before the game starts. And you, before you even draw your opening hand, you choose either 1, 2, or 3. And you may spend mana as though it were mana of any color to cast creature spells with converted mana cost equal to the chosen number. So I chose 2, and that meant all my 2 drops were basically, I could pay any color mana for them.
There are a lot of really good 2 drops in the set, I think.
Well, what allows you to do is you just say, you pick a number when you draft it, basically, and you just say, well, now I can take any 2 drop.
Yeah.
Any 2 drop creature, I can just take it. I don't have to worry about... A couple have activated abilities that require mana, so maybe not every 2 drop, but like 90% of them you can just take.
Yeah,
so... I mean, that card's bonkers.
I mean, it could even be 3 if you draft the next pack and you see, like, Leovold, and you're like, I want to play that card.
I changed my mind. It's 3 now.
It's 3 now, and then everything from there is 3 out. Yep. Do you think 2 is the sweet number for that?
Yeah, that's the number I see chosen basically all of the time. And part of that is that a lot of the 3 drops have those colored mana activations that you were talking about, Josh.
Yeah,
You know, you've got the Monstrous Guy, you've got the Custodian Peacekeeper. There's just a lot of cards.
It doesn't help you to be able to cast.
Yeah, like, being able to cast those guards is not as effective. But all the 2 drops are designed to be pretty strong for whatever deck they go in, and when they can all go in your deck, they're just all going to be naturally quite helpful.
Yeah, certainly. Do we have any standouts for favorite card so far on the set? Glenn, you first.
I mean, I guess I should just give it to Kaya.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't see that coming.
Is really a card I'm
pretty thrilled
with.
I saw a picture
with.
You tweeted, pack one, pick one was Kaya, right?
Yes, at our Wizards release event draft.
Talk about karma.
My pack one, pick one was Kaya, Ghost Assassin. It was the first Conspiracy 2 pack I opened.
And did you end up playing her?
I did, yeah. I drafted a black-white Monarch-based deck that was a lot of fun. Pretty strong. Pretty strong. I enjoyed it.
Okay, now what about a non-rare...
Favorite card? Yeah, Jeering Homunculus, hands down.
Jeering Homunculus. Dude, the art. By the way, I don't know if you guys saw this. It was on the subreddit, but someone made... Did you see the deck box someone made of the Jeering Homunculus?
Oh, no. I have to find it.
I'll pull it up right now. But yeah, Jeering Homunculus is just it's a 2-mana, 1 in the blue for a 0/4, and when it enters the battlefield, you can goad the creature.
We should read goad, because I don't think we did either.
Oh, right. Yeah, good point.
So goad is... until your next turn, the creature that you goaded attacks each combat if able, and attacks a player other than you, if able.
Yeah, it's like you injected it with like an adrenaline like serum. He's like, ah, I gotta go! And they rush at someone, but it's not you.
Right. I love that mechanic also, in theory. I've never played with it yet. But I tend to hate mechanics that force you to make enemies, and love mechanics that force other people to make enemies of each other. And this is other people make enemies of each other. Because if you goad somebody, especially in a 4-player game, You goad them. They have to attack one of the other two players. And either player can get mad they got attacked because you could have still chosen the other player.
Yeah, so it's off of you entirely.
And it's off of you entirely. So it's just great. Such a great mechanic.
Yeah, here it is, Glenn. And we'll put this on the video as well. But it's this incredible tech box that stands on
this
its own.
Is incredible.
And can hold 100 double sleeve cards.
What?
Yeah, the amount of attention and love to just this card that got previewed out of nowhere is insane. I love it to death. The fact that someone was like, I'm just going to make this into the most unique deck box ever made.
Credit to our Story and Worlds team for bringing us all the things that make that card that awesome.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah.
I think my favorite card that is not a rare would be Storm Chaser Chimera. Oh. This card, I was already drafting a blue and red deck. It's a two, a blue and a red for a 2/3 Chimera with flying, and you can pay two red and blue and scry one. Then reveal the top card of your library, and Storm Chaser Chimera gets +X/+0 until end of turn, where X is that card's converted mana cost. So 2/3, I think, is really important. The 3 toughness, I think, is good in this set, and it can just beat down people in the sky. And also, if you don't attack people with it, you just get a scry every turn.
It's a scry one.
Great mana sink,
Yeah, great mana sink. Not to mention, I did win the game with it, so it has a bit of a special place in my heart because I gave it fire breathing with Conspiracy.
It's a good card in Joyra too. Everybody, just FYI.
Yeah.
Hey, you got all like 12 casting cost Eldrazi. You just
drop them.
Just destroy people. Yeah.
+0/+0.
Yeah.
How was the favorite card? What was the favorite card you drafted?
Well, the card I had the most of was Voyaging Satyr. So
you do love that,
which
card.
Is a very Josh card.
Yeah.
Which is, it's a 2-drop. It's a 1/2. You can tap it to untap a land. It seems great with all those conspiracies that cost a colored mana to activate. So if it dies, make a zombie or give it +1/+1, the green one.
Yeah.
Because it makes the mana to do the thing. So if you have 3 of them, you just stack up those conspiracies. That was my plan anyway. I don't know if it was going to work. I only got to turn 4. It seemed like it was going to work.
Yeah, I think Voyaging Satyr is really the green glue for those archetypes.
It seems like there's a lot of fixing, actually, in the set. There's a bunch of cyclers, Explosive Vegetation, Evolving Wild, Shimmering Grotto, Voyaging Satyr.
Lay of the Land.
Voyaging Satyr is not exactly fixing, but it kind of is.
Sylvan Bounty has
the fixing is really structured to incentivize like 2 or 2 with a splash.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are 2 or 2 with a splash, then your mana's good.
I feel like there's Opaline
Going
Unicorn.
Going 5
too.
Is hard.
I feel like 3, though, is actually not difficult.
Yeah. I mean, it depends. Yeah. A lot of the power of being in a given color comes from conspiracies and particular cards. So it gets a little harder to get full value out of your third color, unless you're just splashing a powerful card or 2 or 3. I've definitely seen 3-color decks that were successful, and all of them featured Voyaging Satyr as well to make sure that they could pay the healthier mana requirements.
Mm-hmm.
If you're black, green, blue, or whatever, you still want to cast Murder, though it's harder.
But you need to black.
You still want to do it.
Yeah. I guess the other vote for my favorite is Stunt Double, because I'm a huge fan of clone cards, and a 4-mana clone with Flash, pretty good.
It seems good.
Yeah, I also, that's another card I really like, what the Story and Worlds team brought us with both the name and the art.
The name is
really
great.
Really
tickling. Yeah, it's pretty sweet.
Mel Lee was actually
The
names and flavor rep for this. Like, I worked closely with her on that, and she did a just great job on, I think, all of them. Like, if you like a name or flavor text in this set, like, odds are you have Mel to thank for selecting it or writing it or hammering it into the right shape.
I think we should also mention that this set is great for a lot of cube enthusiasts out there because of the Draft Matters cards. They add an entirely new sort of dimension to drafts. And you guys said that you design with cube in mind as well and sort of make sure that, like, oh, this would be really fun in a cube.
I mean, we know that people have cubes and that they're going to pick up Magic cards that are appealing or fun. Those are certainly just things we want to remain aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely a goal. I wouldn't say that we design, like, specifically to cube necessarily. But, if we have an opportunity, it's always going to be something we make sure is good. And especially in a set like Conspiracy 2, where a larger selection of its audience is going to be the kind of people who are enjoying it outside of just Conspiracy 2, you want to make sure that they have something.
Yeah. It definitely, it's great seeing, because, I pay pretty close attention to Twitter and Reddit and all those sort of forums to see what people get excited about. And you see people coming out of the woodwork being like, I'm really excited about this. I don't post very often, but this card has me very excited. So that's always great to see sort of like the more underserved audiences because, obviously Standard is a very different dynamic than something like Conspiracy. Let's talk about Goad and Marlink a little bit. How early on did everyone sort of know that they wanted to include sort of like these incentivized action cards?
Well, they were already in the set when I first got to Wizards mm-hmm. and started messing around. They had like slightly different forms. I think Goad was mostly the same, although we might have like tweaked a thing about the way it specifically works as you wind down to 1v1. Mm-hmm. So that I think it may have at one point detained the creature functionally versus what it does now, which is pretty close to nothing or it just instigates the creature.
You mean right. when it's 1v1?
Yeah, once you're down to one player versus one player.
Gotcha.
Can make them run their creature into yours, though.
Yeah, it comes up. Like, it just shifts. Like, once you're at three or more players, you're usually picking their biggest guy. Yeah. Once you're at two, you're picking the smallest.
Small guy and just killing it. Yeah.
So, I like the idea of, like, yelling at the little person, and they're like, okay, fine, I'll attack you. And you're like, gotcha.
Then, as far as Monarch goes, I know that it was bounced around for a little bit, and they tried a variety of different effects for it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the development article for the set, or the design article for the set, actually mentioned that at one point it used to make a creature, but they found that a card that traded hands based on having creatures in play that also then made creatures wound up being
snowball. Right.
Just really a little bit much. And the card, I think, is a really great sweet spot. There's a cost benefit going on just to being the Monarch in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
It draws fire, but it also fuels your ability to defend yourself. Yeah, just I think it landed in a sweet spot.
Yeah. It seems like a really good mechanic. I think it's pretty obviously like a fixed version of Dethrone, as Dethrone ended up being not that great. But it encourages what you want to encourage in a way that
it has the same goals.
Right. Dethrone wants you to attack, right? It wants to... I compare it to the blinds in poker where...
yep.
Because in poker, if you don't know, what happens in poker is there are forced bets. So if you have like eight people at the table, two people have to put out a certain amount of money. They have to bet it before you get your cards. And the goal of that in poker is that if you don't have blind bets, then there's no incentive because there's nothing in the pot. So there's no stakes. So you never have to play any cards. So the game just doesn't happen. But when there's something in the pot that you want to grab, now all of a sudden that creates action. People are trying to grab it, so they start betting and they start making moves. The Monarch seems almost exactly that, which is what multiplayer needs.
Yeah.
Multiplayer Magic needs. I think it's actually really good for Commander that Monarch exists, and hopefully we'll get more of it, because that can be a problem with our format, which is that there's not a lot of incentive to take action because there's not any short-term goal of action taking, whereas mm-hmm. there's only the long-term goal of I kill you. But if an action I'm going to take is not actually going to kill you right now, 90% of the time it's better to just do nothing and not open the doors to anything happening to me. But if there's a short-term goal, which Monarch gives you, Monarch, we should say, is a mechanic where...
Finally, we explained
it. Yeah, sorry.
40 minutes into the podcast.
We should bring up a card so I can read it exactly, because I'm gonna screw it up the wording. But
I mean, I can certainly just say it.
Oh, here's the guy, actually. I'm gonna read it. No, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, a variety of cards have the ability, you know, ... You become the Monarch. Being the Monarch is a status. It's not. It doesn't put anything into play. It's just a designation that the player now possesses, and it just has the effect that at the beginning of your end step, you draw a card. Note that is a mandatory draw.
Mm-hmm.
Not an optional one. And then whenever a creature deals combat damage to you, the controller of that creature gains control of the Monarch. They become the new king.
Once somebody's the Monarch, the ability to become a Monarch is on the table. And then anybody who hits that Monarch becomes the Monarch.
Mm-hmm. Right. The game doesn't start with the Monarch.
Right. A card has to make it.
Yeah.
It's an endless series of coups.
Yeah, that's great. It's like King of the Hill, kind of.
I mean, it does so many things, and one of the problems, I think, with the first Conspiracy, and again, first Conspiracy was awesome. One of maybe the issues was that there was a lot of decking that happened. In our experience, mm-hmm. we actually started playing with four packs because the decks weren't powerful enough with three packs for people to win without at least one person being decked most of the time, because there wasn't something like driving action. And I think another thing that does for Commander is it gives white and red, especially white, a way to start drawing cards, because that, in a way that feels good for that color, because white, we talk about all the time, just has a real problem and now you can have Monarch cards, which I think helps white quite a bit. If you just, even just a few, you can count as like card draw cards for you, because you were likely to be attacking more.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like you know, it might not be the flashiest mechanic or the one that's the most fun, but it probably will end up being like the mechanic that for multiplayer is sort of the best, because it's just something we always needed. We just need something that drives action.
It's a thing inherent to any multiplayer game with unforced action. Like you have to give the players a carrot or they won't move. Because
it's actually disadvantageous.
Just incentivizes someone to move against you specifically a lot of the time. But by providing a carrot, you give people something to gain out of action. And also, depending on the action, you know, maybe they don't want to do it. Like, I've had a lot of games where my goal was specifically to make one person become the monarch because decking them was going to be the easiest way to defeat them.
Right.
Which is super interesting. I mean, you talk about that too, Jimmy.
Yeah.
Where it's like the table sort of goes, okay, let's not unmonarch this person because that will actually kill them. That's like your greed killing you. That's so good.
Yeah. Well, it's great too because the rest of the table can still swing freely at each other.
Yeah.
The citizens can squabble while the king's above like, I'm bleeding out. Slowly but surely. Let's talk about the set itself and drafting it and stuff. The set is still fairly new. I think in general because it's sort of like a very unique experience, people won't be drafting it as much. So as a result, I think there's going to be a lot of sleeper hits.
Make for yourself, man. I'm going to draft the crap out of it.
Well, I mean, me too. But, you know, I feel like it's a great set to be like, hey, do you want to try this out, this new thing? And so I feel like a lot of our listeners might be in that group as well. Are there any cards so far that have popped out as sort of the, like, don't overlook this card. It's actually very good. Goad, obviously, like you're saying, Jeering Homunculus, you think is super powerful. So I really like that as a start. Anyone else? Josh?
I don't know yet. I'm actually going to... I've got my phone out to take notes when Glenn tells me what cards are better.
Another really... this card is super bread and butter, but I think a lot of people don't evaluate how important cards like this are to just formats in general. Negate is actually just a card. It's so simple, like everyone... But, you know, you want to be able to negate some spells. Like, the spells that come your way are often the ones that will kill you, so...
I think Commander players know the power of negate because in multiplayer it's just so much better than it is on in 1v1. Mm-hmm. You are never going to have a game where you can't use your negate, whereas in 1v1 there's going to be games where it just sits in your hand and you never... Yeah. You're in trouble and that's not saving you. But in multiplayer there's four other players or three other players... There's going to be something that comes your way during the course of the game that's important that you get rid of for 2 mana.
And I found that in almost every game, there comes a situation where it goes, if this player dies next to me, then I'm guaranteed done for. Because whatever they're doing is providing some kind of safe haven for me. And if someone else goes after them, negating someone else's spell targeting someone else gains you both an ally and also will potentially save your life. One thing I found that has been pretty effective so far is there aren't that many board wipes in the format. But there are a lot of X1s and a lot of X2s. So both Fester Gloom and Infest I've found have been like 5-for-1s, 6-for-1s, 4-for-1s every single time they've been played. So I think Infest is just very powerful in the set, especially if you can build your deck around not having a bunch of X2s that will die when you play it. But
you know my rule of all multiplayer drafting queue, multiplayer queue, don't pass board wipes.
Yeah, they're pretty good. And then
they're the only cards that get you out of certain jams. Like, there's so many times where you look around and the only card that would ever save you is a board wipe.
Yeah.
There's very few times where you say, the only card that will save me is, you know, a 5/5.
I also really like all the monstrous cards. Monstrous is a mechanic from Theros Block, correct?
Yeah.
And it gives you a regular creature and then you can at any point pay an additional amount of mana and it'll say monstrosity and the number and you put that number of +1/+1 counters on it, and a lot of times that will also come with an additional effect like Sinuous Vermin's just a 2/2 for 2, but you monstrous it becomes a 5/5 with menace, which all of a sudden can just straight up kill someone in the game. And it's nice too because there are so many turns where you just draw a card and say pass because you don't want to do anything, you don't want to attack, and you have instants in your hands and you also have more options available to you. So I like that a lot. It reminds me of sort of why Eldritch Moon has been one of my more favorite sets recently. Is because of all the werewolves have all similar monstrous abilities, but just to flip onto their other side.
Mm-hmm.
Well, mana sinks are just so powerful, especially in games where we've talked about decking, so you know the games are going to go a little bit long. So just having mana sinks, because there's just going to be times where you don't have cards in your hand, being able to use your mana is just going to be better than not being able to use your mana, because... If let's say I have a monstrous creature and you don't, and we both are top decking, like how much better position am I in? Because I have a turn where I draw a land and I play it, and now I do something, and you draw a land and you did nothing.
Yeah, I obviously was familiar with monstrous before working at Wizards, I actually really liked the Theros Born Journey mm-hmm. limited format. I saw a ton of success in that, and Monstrous was a really appealing mana sink. And I specifically, when I first saw it, you know, it called to mind for me Kavu Titan in some ways, who was like the poster child for Kicker when it first came mm-hmm. out ages mm-hmm. and ages ago, you know.
Right,
it's a another. It's a bear if you need a bear, or if you don't need a bear, it's something else later on for a little more mana.
Yeah.
And so Monstrous has some similar action. It plays differently. A lot of Monstrous cards from Theros Block specifically started out pretty big and just got much bigger.
Yeah, yeah.
But it plays a little closer to Kavu Titan in Conspiracy 2, where the Monstrous creatures are smaller or mid-sized and then just become supersized
with
a little
like a lot of times they do something around
yeah not a little knob yeah. to make it into a legitimate fatty. So it's like, you know, sometimes you just want a 3-mana 2/3 to block, sometimes your deck needs a benthic behemoth just so you have some giant hexproof guy to attack with. Well, Skittering Crustacean, the man for you.
Yeah, Skittering Crustacean. Yeah, amazing card so far. Hexproof, always good.
The invertebrate for you, I guess I should
yeah.
say.
Yeah. I've also found that Life Gain, we always talk about how it's just not good.
It's so good in Conspiracy.
Yeah, it's just not good in Commander, but someone had a Sangromancer out and played an Infest, and all of a sudden that person was not just winning the game, they were dominating the game because they could freely swing. The crackbacks did nothing to them, and if you ever block them swinging, they were just going to gain back the life that you were potentially going to do them damage-wise.
Yeah, life is very valuable in a game that is all about position.
Well,
yeah.
And you think about, that's one big difference you have to calculate. Is we're used to Commander, 40 life is a big thing in Commander. Because if you have two players attack you and you have 40 life, it's like one player attacked you in a 20 life game. If you have two players attack you in 20 life game, that's like...
It's like two players attacked
you. That's like somebody got an extra turn against you, basically. So it's just so much... Life gain's so much better. I still wouldn't play like a card that said, give me 8 life, but... Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like a recurable, even gain one life a turn type of card is just very, very good.
A deck I tried to draft recently and I had to audible out of because the red was getting cut, which wound up being my winning white-blue deck. But I was trying to get into the Gutter Snipe Reviving Dose deck, which is actually pretty sweet.
Gain life, deal damage to every opponent.
And draw a card.
Yeah.
Lightning Helix everybody.
That seems decent. Is blue-white still good? Because I thought it was the best.
Oh, it's been
I thought
good
it was
me.
The best in Conspiracy.
I've won with pretty much everything. I hope to continue to do so. But yeah, I really like blue. White can pair with every color in interesting and different ways. You know, you've got white-red, which is go wide, pretty aggressive, can mm-hmm. play a lot of cards that other people won't, like Trumpet Blast. And then you can go into blue-white, very controlling, totally different. White-black, monarch-based, like mm-hmm. that's all about manipulating card advantage and drain effects. Also totally different. And then white-green, bring the beef, like size everyone up. It also can go wide with strength and numbers as a payoff instead. White is really versatile, but the valuations on certain cards switch pretty significantly depending on what your second color is. So if you're drafting white, it's a lot harder to just stay the course in white and then pick up your second color. You're way more likely to have a color and then pick up the white cards you need.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's do some, when should you draft it? Garbage Fire. It's 2 in a red for an instant. You reveal Garbage Fire as you draft it, and you know how many cards you've drafted this draft round, including Garbage Fire. So it's per pack. So if you draft this card third, it's 3. If you draft it fourth, it's 4. And Garbage Fire is a 2 in a red for an instant that deals damage to target creature equal to the highest number you know for cards named Garbage Fire. Where is the sweet spot here? I've seen it go for 8.
Well, I think
it's
got to depend on what pack, right? Because in the first pack, you could take it lower, hoping to get another one.
In a later pack?
Because
I think the reverse is true, actually. Because if you take it early in pack 1, then they know not to pass you later ones because
and that way
it'll be like passing you 2.
True, but you also don't want to pick it because somebody else is already sort of on it, right?
Well, if it's getting to a high enough number. Like, for example, you know, like, let's say I take an early one, like second or third,
right.
Planning to gamble. Now we're in pack 2, it's pick 6 or something, someone sees a Garbage Fire, like, okay, I could pass him this, and now
his Garbage Fire
pay 3, deal 3 turns into pay 3, deal 7 twice.
That's a good point.
Or I could just take this, put a mountain in my deck, see what happens.
Yeah.
I'll take my 2R, deal 6, not too shabby. You know, I think there's some temptation.
No one's passing it at 6, right? 6 is...
I saw it go to 8. I don't know why. I was baffled. I was also one more pick away from me who had 2.
Yeah. It has to get on 3, and then somehow the next 3 people just aren't in red.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think because it's 2R, it's a lot harder to get them late, so I prefer to not pick them in pack one much at all unless it's pretty late. Like, I'll pick four is right about where I start picking it in pack one, and I don't think I would take one for less.
At four, it's a fireball kind of, you know. It's
I mean, you know, there's some limitations. A lot of the cards that wind up killing you are really annoying and big.
Yeah, yeah. Not to mention Flame Slash is at one mana as a sorcery speed and does four, so you have to think, you kind of have to compare those two both at common. Animus of Predation, this card I love. Four and a green for a 4/4. You draft it face up, and as you draft a card, you can remove it from the draft face up, and you just sort of tuck it under the Animus of Predation. And if you remove a creature card with flying from the draft under Animus of Predation, this card now has flying. And if you remove a creature with first strike, and now it's first strike, it does it for double strike, death touch, haste, hexproof, indestructible, lifelink, menace, reach, and vigilance, everything but trample. So what are the sweet spots here? Because you would say Hexproof, but I think there's only one Hexproof card in the set with Ascend the Law Mage.
Yeah, there's a ton of awesome Animus of Predations. In general, you want to try and get Flying and Lifelink above everything else. Those are the two most important ones.
Yeah.
You can get some other abilities, but this is the gravy spot. Like, you're just Flying, Lifelink, boom, I have a Baneslayer Angel.
But on this one, you can take a card that's not, like, it doesn't care about the color of the card or anything.
No,
right?
It does not.
No, yeah.
So you can get, like, late pick something with any ability. Late it's just like
Ascended Law Mage is actually not that uncommon to get late because you have to be white blue to take it.
And oh my god, Lifelink
Vigilance.
That's
why this card seems amazing, is because what you're going to do is take the picks 12, 13, 14, and which you wouldn't even play in your deck, and you're actually adding value to your deck with a, like I'm not in blue, but I can take a Vaporkin and give this thing flying.
Well, every pick becomes exciting from 10 and on or whatever, because you're like, what can I, am I going to get a Child of Night?
Yeah,
if I,
I can either get a card that's in my color, or I can get a card that has an ability that will go on this guy.
Yeah. Capital Punishment, good or bad or great? I think this card is great. I've had a lot of arguments. I've never seen it played, and I've never had it played against me yet. So it's 4BB. It's one of the few vote cards in the set, Council's Dilemma. It's a sorcery. Starting with you, each player votes for death or taxes, and each opponent sacrifices a creature for each death vote and discards a card for each taxes vote. But it costs 6 mana. The argument I've heard against it is that at that point, everyone's just going to vote for discard because they'll have no hand size. Or everyone can sort of play around it, quote in quotes, based on what their board is.
They'll have enough creatures that one won't do it. Because you can always make sure that everybody sacrifices one card, right? Or one creature.
I think this card is great just because of the... I'm sort of the best case scenario mentality in my head of just, it could just destroy the board. And everyone gets to choose, like, oh, sweet, we can finally get rid of that thing, you know?
Well, I'm curious to hear what you say, Glenn, but I haven't played this set enough. I think it would be determined by if it's the type of set where people usually have cards in their hand around turn 7 or turn 8.
Yeah.
Do they or do they not? I think the first conspiracy was more towards not. You tended to be run out of gas. There wasn't a ton of draw spells. You didn't have the Monarch mechanic to make people draw things. I'm not sure about this one. It feels like... I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's quite strong, mostly because of the Monarch mechanic. That's really... Like, if you think Unnerve is a solid card, then there's not really a reason to think Capital Punishment is worse, because getting an extra card and a creature for the 2 mana is totally reasonable.
But if you... Unnerve makes your opponent's disc... No, makes... Yeah, your opponent discard 2 cards, right? And it's 4 mana? But I mean, if you just cast that on 4, you're going to get 2 cards from most people.
Yeah, I'm saying because of Monarch, I think that you often get the additional cards. And especially, you know, if you're actually thinking that most of your opponents will have no hands on turn 6, like, that's awesome too, because that game should be pretty easy to win.
You should be winning that game,
Every game I've ended, I've had a full grip, and it was a fight. Like, we were, you know, going long, and... The people who run out of cards, those are the people who wind up getting picked off. So the fact that it isn't maybe strong against the weakest player at your table is not a strong knock against it. Yeah, like it's strong against the strongest players at your table.
Right, absolutely.
That's a really interesting way to look at it. I like that.
Yeah. All right, finally, what is the one conspiracy you want to see in your pack one, pick one above all the other ones? For me, I really, really, really just want to see Sovereign's Realm. it's a conspiracy you start the game with. Your deck can't have basic land cards, and your starting hand size is 5, but you can exile a card from your hand at any time during your turn, and this turn you may play basic land cards from outside the game. So essentially, every card you draw, if you don't like it, or another card in your hand, you can say, like, I'm going to make this a basic land instead, and each basic land adds any mana of any color to your mana pool, or the mana of any
color. It's the sort of new world knit.
Yeah, it's...
The fair world knit.
They're different, I would say.
I'm just saying, like, it feels like...
Yeah. It is a spiritual success.
World Knit was really, really good. This feels really, really good still, though.
That's the one I want. I would love to build a deck around this and see if having if auto mulling to five is going to kill me or not.
Yeah. My roommate affectionately refers to that card as Play Duel Masters, another fine Wizards product. my pick would be Sovereign's Realm because I haven't gotten the luxury of pick one yet, despite having done like 15 Conspiracy 2 drafts in my life or something. So frustrating. Gosh.
We're going to get there.
One day. But I guess for the sake of diversification, I would take Echoing Boon. I've drafted some pretty insane Echoing Boon decks.
Oh, yeah. This is a card that
is really strong. It's a hidden agenda. You name a creature, and then whenever you play an instant or sorcery that targets that creature, you copy it. It's a little unique from previous effects, such as the ones we've seen on things like Zada or whatever, in that it doesn't restrict to single target effects, and it also doesn't restrict to only your creatures.
Right.
So, yeah, you can do some pretty crazy stuff. I've double duplicated Windborne Charge. That was pretty awesome.
Plus,
Fleeting Distraction is Ancestral Vision in that scenario as well.
My goodness.
Or Ancestral Recall, I should say.
Yeah, yeah.
With a, you know, -2/-0 to one of the guys tagged on.
Darn. Shucks.
So, yeah, I think that card is just really fun to build around. You can build a lot of different Echoing Boon decks. And, yeah, it's a card I'm pretty happy to be first picking.
I'm going to say Weight Advantage. I think you got to draft it a little bit earlier so you can build your deck that way. It sort of makes your deck into a Duran deck. It's a conspiracy, starts in your command zone. Each creature you control assigns combat damage equal to its toughness rather than its power. Seems pretty sweet.
Yeah.
Just the big butts deck seems cool.
The homunculus that goads is now a 4/4 for 2 mana, so hey.
Well, yeah, it seems like it will turn a lot of cards that nobody wants into really good cards for you.
Yeah.
And it's an effect you're guaranteed to have, too, so it's not like building around, what was that green enchantment recently that did?
Assault Formation, yeah.
Which was really fun to draft and try and make work, but you had to draw that card.
Yep.
So sometimes you would build that deck and be like, I never drew it, so my deck sucked. This is a conspiracy, so it's going to happen. So you can draft, your 0/4s or your 1/4s. Like, Omen Speaker is amazing now because that's a 3/3 that scries 2 when it comes in for 2 mana. Like, and
Scrywolf at that point.
Yeah. And Omen Speaker goes around pretty late. So I think that card, like, I like cards like that. Turn all the crappy cards that nobody wants into A's or B pluses in your deck.
And no one can interact with it. The cards that you're looking to wheel are just so absurd compared to your opponents.
Yeah.
You're like, boy, I hope this 0/4 comes back.
Yeah. That card is really strong, and it's best in white, blue, and black, especially in this set, I should say. You know, those colors are designed with a lot of high toughness, especially because white and black are focused around the Monarch, so their creatures are really built to kind of brawl as blockers, and the Weight Advantage makes them brawl a lot harder. You know, green's got square stats, red tends to favor power, so you know, if you're in Esper color combinations is where you really want to be for Weight Advantage.
It seems like, blue's great because you're going to get flying a lot of times with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So just... Oh.
Don't be tricked. Duran, the Siege Tower, is green, but... In general, like you said, box creatures.
In this format, you know, there are certainly formats where that's not true.
Yeah, definitely. I think that just about wraps up. One final question for you here, Glenn. How many conspiracy sets are we likely to get in the future?
Wait, we had a multiple choice.
Yeah, multiple choice. So you want to list them off, Josh?
Yeah, so how many more conspiracy sets are we likely to get in the future? Choice A, 1 million. Choice B, more than 1 million. Choice C, all of the above.
Is a very fair poll.
Oh, yeah. This is tough. It's like one of those is substantially larger than the other.
You should probably hedge your bets.
Yeah, I guess I'll take the one closest to true, A. but I'll be quite frank, if we ever make more than 1 million of any Magic the Gathering set, I'll personally
timeline.
Be thrilled.
Yeah,
just means this game has gone on for so long, and that would be awesome.
I mean, the big ways, obviously, the more that we play it and obviously go to stores and draft it with friends, the more Wizards knows that it's a successful set. So
yeah, I mean, it's true, the better a set does, like, the more likely we are to repeat it or things like it. But, you know, we have a lot of different ancillary lines, and we love exploring these things that players just you know, we got to figure out what people really like, give them diverse play experiences. We just announced a lot of new product lines. One of them is Archenemy Nicol Bolas.
So
already know about an upcoming multiplayer experience. Yeah. So, yeah.
This is something we talk to the, our listeners about a lot, and we're going to say it here again, which is that we got to support the products that are aimed at us. And Conspiracy is aimed at us, and the Commander products are aimed at us. And by us, I mean the casual players, the players that aren't necessarily going to a GP and trying to play on the Pro Tour. You know, we're playing Magic with our friends, you know, at our house or you know, at a local bar or at our LGS, but we're not, we don't have these aspirations of like making Magic our life. It's just a fun diversion, and this kind of product is made directly for us. So if you haven't tried it, you need to go try it. It's awesome.
It's a blast, man. Yeah, it does what great sequels do. It iterates on the original, and in my opinion so far has been even more fun than the original. So
you guys are killing me. I only played 4 turns of it.
I really love Conspiracy 2 and all of these ancillary lines and the different play experiences we have. And one of the nice things about them is actually social media just makes having these and experiencing them so much more fun. Like I've talked with, you know, my friends from back home in Florida, which is where I'm originally from, like clear across the country about
Fort Myer.
How much they like this set. I do have some family in Fort Myer, but not where I am personally from. Yeah. That's awesome. And seeing like the week that we released Conspiracy 2 and going to Reddit and seeing like everyone talking about like what they had done and their favorite cards and what they found cool, like that's something that everyone in R&D and I'm sure at Wizards at large like just loves to do. So that is honestly like the most fun way you can certainly support a lot of us, is just make known what you love, and we'll definitely try and make more of it.
One of the rare times that Reddit is overwhelmingly positive. Anyway, moving on to the listeners. Have any of you guys played Conspiracy 2 yet? What are your thoughts? I'd love to hear all of the crazy combos that you guys have assembled, and also what your favorite element of the set is. I think for a lot of people, it's going to be like, I can't wait to play X card in this deck as well. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to see
what your favorite archetype is.
Yeah, certainly. So yeah, Josh can play more than 4 turns.
I need to learn from you guys because I haven't played a lot yet. I'm sure I'm going to get my butt kicked all weekend too. We're playing with all the people who make the game.
Yeah, and they know the target.
Not worried. Josh. I'm not worried. Well, we all know to target Glenn because he's...
I'm on a 4-0 heater. Like,
who keeps saying that? It's almost like he wants us to kill
excited.
Him first.
I'm pretty excited. Well, the last two pods also thought that the 2-0 and 3-0 claims may have some attention.
Man, he is just throwing it out there. Yes. He is just throwing it out there. Well, perhaps we will play tomorrow night, Glenn, when we're all at Card Kingdom, who is our sponsor. Go to cardkingdom.com/commandzone, order your cards there, and you will be supporting this podcast, The Command Zone.
It's and Conspiracy 2.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you should be ordering your Conspiracy 2 stuff. I mean, if you haven't already, yeah, put in a big order for that. I did.
Yeah, and I hope to see you guys a lot at Card Kingdom tomorrow. Obviously, you're going to hear this on Tuesday after it's happened.
We hope we saw you a lot.
It was a blast.
It was awesome.
I had a ton of fun. CardKingdom.com/CommandZone. All right.
So it's time for the end step, where we talk about something cool outside the world of Magic.
Glenn, do you have something cool outside the world of Magic?
Yeah, actually, I just watched The Get Down on Netflix with my roommates. I had watched the first episode, and I was like, oh, this is great. So I told my roommates, like I do with everything I watch that isn't awful, like, hey, we should watch this together. And we started doing that at 10 p.m., like Saturday night, and at 5 a.m., we were done and we went to sleep.
You know the show's
that's
good, though.
That's good how show. Good that yeah. show is. Yeah. Wow. I love that show. Like, it was so, so rewarding. Really
What's a brief synopsis of it, for those that don't know?
Brief synopsis of The Get Down? Sure. It's Baz Luhrmann, who is a director I personally really enjoy. Mm-hmm. He did... Romeo and Juliet, Moulin Rouge, greatest movie of all time. The Great Gatsby recently, which was not his finest hour. But I really like Baz Luhrmann because he does his stuff is so musical. I love music. And The Get Down is a lot. It's fictional, but it's a story about a lot of different elements in 1977 New York, late 80s, and the rise of hip-hop and the kind of fall of disco, and also a lot about like the crime that was going on in that area. So there's just a lot of different threads. New York at that time was a very exciting and interesting place. The characters are great. It was just like a slam dunk for me. I didn't have any complaints when I was
I've heard a lot of good things about the show. Man, Netflix?
Yeah.
Netflix is killing,
killing it. Destroying it.
They're just like Babe Ruth in it every time. They're like, hey, this show? It's yeah, going over the bridge.
They're kind of the new HBO, man.
Certainly.
HBO's still good, don't get me wrong. But.
Well, they're definitely following. I mean, AMC, Netflix, all those guys are following in what HBO established, which is like, let's make primo shows that are complete experiences, not based on mm-hmm. viewership numbers and tell stories.
Let's become known for what we offer and not like the people we contract with.
Yeah.
But it's also, they're taking risks. Like all the risky, cool things are happening mm-hmm. on TV now. I feel like movies have gotten really sort of stale. They have to play it very safe, and they have to because of the amount of money involved, while the HBOs and the Netflixes of the world are doing stuff that, like, come on. What you just described is not a show you would normally think of to get greenlit. Stranger Things is another show like that. It's just great.
More importantly, Disco never died. It's still here, guys. It's just called Lady Gaga now. All right, let's move on to the cleanup step.
Oh, make sure you listen to our sister podcast, The Masters of Modern, where Glenn Jones originally started out. Well, it's not actually true, but it's
that was his beginning. It's where World of Magic.
Yeah, totally 100% not true, but that's where we, Jimmy and I, first met him. You can follow The Masters of Modern at the MMcast on Twitter. Alex Kessler, Ben Bateman. They talk about modern format and all things competitive magic.
Before we shout out our editor, Glenn, where can we find you online?
Oh, you can find me at Secluded Glenn with two N's, because that's how I spell my name. That's Twitter, and yeah, that's pretty much my only real social media presence anymore these days.
Yes. Tweet all your Kaya pictures to Glenn, especially if it's the alternate art. Our editor for the show is Terry Robertson. He does all of our video content. You guys can check that out, including this podcast at youtube.com/thecommandzonepodcast. We show all the card images. It's a great experience. It's a great way to enjoy the podcast. And also read along, because we spent a lot of time talking about cards and not explaining what they were until much later in this show. Good team, us. Good job.
But Terry, he solves all that.
Yeah, he solved it.
He just shows it to you.
Yeah, it's perfect. And special thanks to Jeffrey Palmer, who does the Living Card animations at the show. You can find him online at LivingCardsMTG.
Glenn, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, it was great. Thank you for having me, guys. Awesome.
I love PAX.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening.
And we'll see you next time.
Peace.
For further inquiries, send an email to commandcast@rocketjump.com or ask us on Twitter @JFWong and @JoshLeeKwai. See you later, alligator.
Greetings, humans.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Hey, I'm Nolan Sykes, a host of Past Gas, the number one automotive podcast in the world. Every week, my co-hosts, James Pumphrey, Joe Weber, and I bring you some of our favorite stories from the hallowed halls of car history. From the amazing to the weird to the utterly unforgettable moments, we cover it all. Join us as we take a look at the wild stories and larger-than-life characters behind legendary cars and car makers. So if you love cars or just like a good story, check out Past Gas by Donut Media, the number one automotive podcast in the world.